Fuzzy vans, broken cars, zippy scooters, seaworthy boats, well-worn farm equipment, family-sized SUVs, old jet skis, and more. If your vehicle has a clean title, we can take it as a donation. If your vehicle isn't working, we can work with that too. Call 877-KBOO-123. That's 877-526-6123. Or go to our website, kboo.fm/vehicle.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
This is MF Grimm. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This feels like home being here. Keep hip hop alive.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Lady Sings the Blues, a tribute to Billie Holiday 2023. On Saturday, April 8th, from 8 p.m. to 10:45 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland. The 16th annual Billie Holiday Tribute brings together musicians of many genres to pay tribute to influential jazz singer and songwriter Billie Holiday. Performances feature Marsha Hocker, LaRonda Steele, Arietta Ward, and more. Again, that's the 16th annual Billie Holiday Tribute Night, Lady Sings the Blues, on Saturday, April 8th, from 8 p.m. to 10:45 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's a weird scenario when everybody agrees that I know that the system is broken, or if it's not broken, it's doing the negative thing that it's trying to do, right? And then also acknowledges that it gets it wrong, right? And all the problems, and also says, yeah, but you have a conviction.
You know, it's crazy, like, you know, Tin Can Phone, it started in prison, you know, and when we came home, they kept like our first interviews and all of our first content in bondage. We had to start over, you know what I'm saying? We lost our mind and we lost Joe, but we gained Blue, Tin Can Phone.
Hit that time and I bounce back. Had us in the beanies, now snap back. Boys in blue trying to snap back. Trying to make sure that my guys never go back. Ain't worried about the instants in the Snapchats. I'm worried about the homies on just close to relax. It's messed up when you know the dealer and the buy. Look him in his eyes, I can tell if he lying. Been locked up with gorillas in the lines. Yeah, respect to get you far and don't move around blind. Forget about the chow hall, ain't waiting in line. Bust down on the bed, spread with the homies. Not no more, we on the streets waiting for him. Free such and such, free with you why. We all on KBOO talking it out. Me, Mike, and Blue and a couple of guests. Popping knowledge like Petro, who got the gas? Doing the work, trying to heal for my past. Politicking on the yard, trying to touch me a bag. Mike was on the yard with the hitters and the sav. Orange beanie on his head with the thing in the bag. Blue photo shoot fresh, sharp enough to cut a wrist. First day of school, cooling ain't with the cuddling. Tin can phone, yes, gang in the bitch. Tin can phone, yes, gang in the bitch. Tin can phone, yes, gang in the bitch. Mike, Blue, Queens.
The more people in society that say, like, we got you, the more that society can welcome people back, the better. But there's going to be those people that say, no, this is, you know, is this safe or is this good or is this positive? I guess I could say what I wish the answer to your question would be. Like, yeah. My hope for all of us, right, is that we, like, are treated according to the content of our character, right? Sure. Like, to make it, like, not even have to use the classic line, which is so perfect, right? That's all any of us want to be. Like, meet me on this day, and if everything you know about me is that I treat people with kindness and respect and try to do positive things, like, meet me there. And then there's also this thing, like, everybody has the right to know, like, this scarlet letter or, like, this, like, thing over your head that says convict, right? there's a belief out there, and I don't know whether it comes from privilege or entitlement or whatever, that the first thing that we should say is, hi, my name's Blue and I'm formerly incarcerated. And that without doing that, you're somehow not entering into like social contract in a way that makes sense for people. And I'm not going to do it.
Like, no, no.
It's not how I'm going to live my life. And when I share my story and my trauma and my experience, the things that have also turned me into the person that I am as well, the goods and the bads, that's going to be when I'm ready, right? It's going to be when I feel comfortable, when I feel safe, when I feel that I have a relationship with somebody that's an important thing for them to know. Sometimes that's the first day I meet them. Sometimes if I meet a person who just got out, I say, guess what? I know because I've been there and I got you, you know, just like I wanted somebody to say that to me.
Mm-hmm.
So other people, maybe I never want to tell them, you know, and I think that's an important nuance.
Well, something that comes up a lot. I mean, in the conversation around the doc, but also like for you, is that some people find out without you saying anything and then they're like coming at you. And like as a person who's running businesses and things, like they're also trying to sabotage your livelihood, right? And so that kind of stuff is like, yeah, we're citizens. The government and cops said this guy is a bad guy and we agree this time, and let's all go get our pitchforks and like burn everything down. Do you know of instances, or either of you, or like where that kind of happens? I mean, because it's not just non-unanimous, it's everyone who's carrying a charge.
I feel like the importance, like Big Bro was talking about earlier, with getting it changed from inmate to adult in custody, that seems small, right? But we talking about a world where doing your own research doesn't exist for real, right? So when you hear inmate, and all we known and have been known to know about adults in custody is that they're inmates, and the stigma that comes with inmate, changing that first from the inside, where the CEOs and the people that's governing us, where, you know, you have to address, because what's the one thing we say when CEOs talk bad to us? Like, hey man, I'm a man first before any other. So we present that. So to be an adult in custody is way more presentable than being an inmate, because I don't even really know the real definition of inmate. Like, I don't really know what that even is for real. But like coming home, I used to, like, understanding that from my culture and coming from the streets, I spoke on it before, like going to the pen is a stature thing. Like, it ain't nobody I know that's like scared to go to the pen. Like, can't wait to get to the pen, because then you get that up under your belt. You get that stature, you know what I'm saying? That certain, like, if you ain't doing certain things, you ain't gonna never get this. It's a badge of honor. So that's without knowing what happens when you really get caught into the system. Like, we so quick to the homie's going to the pen and he's so tough and he's so that, but you would never get your life back. Nobody ever talks about the parole side and being a second class citizen and losing votes, and nobody talks about that part, you know? So like, for regular citizens, even with bosses, every job I get, I always sit down with my boss and I let them know, like, listen, not only am I dealing with urban trauma, but I've done 10 years in the pen, you know what I'm saying? And I really come from a hardball lane. So just so you could get an understanding of why I move the way I move, I don't go around my job hella friendly and I'm just not him, because I didn't see, you know, friendly ones get ate up in the streets. So I can't be super friendly and super, but that stigma, you feel me? I got to make sure I live as I want people to see me. Like, so many times people be like, you don't even look like you spent the day in prison. You don't got all these tattoos and you not hella buff and all these things, like, to where I'm like, damn, I done it. Don't even got to tell nobody. Like, a motherfucker ain't even going to believe me if I tell them I went to the pen, not alone just going to the pen, but doing a whole 10 piece. You feel what I'm saying? So like, I feel like when you could challenge what people most likely only heard, then, you know, like, it's characteristics. A lot of people live that stigma, like, yeah, I was in the pen. Mm-hmm. I was in the pen. You know what I'm saying? So you're going to get that reaction back from the community. But like, when you're dealing with these people every day, like, it's not a shameful thing that you was in the pen. It's only shameful of what they believe. And like I always say, and especially with Trauma Almost One, if you could change somebody's mind, you could change the narrative, you could change their belief, you change their life. You get what I'm saying? Because it could be, we work next to regular citizens. For me, the reason why I don't necessarily tell everybody I've been to the pen is because I get to see what they believe I am and how they react to me not knowing any of that. Not that I'm hiding it, or not that if it came up, I wouldn't. But because I know what my mind tell me people see, my flaws that I know I have, I believe people see. and then carrying that inmate with me, we believe people see it. So the good thing about that is you get to see how people treat you without knowing that you ever walked them yards. And then you get to change their mind, you get to change their narrative, you get to change their beliefs once you express to them, like, yeah, but I really done I really done did them decades in there, and like I really stepped like that, but I'm here. And I wanted to ask you too, from my understanding, you come from that hardball lane, you come from that grit of them streets, and how was it when you decided to like make that change and like I'm finna really go into this lane real hard? And did you lose people that you thought was close to you that really didn't understand that? And because I know, like, for me, a lot of homies ain't homies no more. Like, a lot of people that was in that circle and existing in my life, once it became this route and I went full throttle on this, it's like, you know, a lot of people started falling off. Like, how was that for you?
So when I got to the prison system, there was this expectation of me. And I fell into that expectation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just natural because of who I was. I was the type of person to see disorder and knew how to bring some type of order without being overly aggressive and make it resonate with them. So it felt like, you know, not felt like, but like they were part of making this decision themselves and not being dictated, but still had an understanding that somebody had to be at the helm to make sure stuff didn't get out of order. So I was caught up in that for a minute. And so then that elevated for the first 10 years. I came in a position to where, you know, I was really caught up in saying, you know what, I'm doing 30, 33 plus years, whatever, man, I'm finna just run this prison. And I got in that mind frame. And then everybody was like, hell yeah, finally somebody with some leadership and some such and such. And then it got to the point to where I actually sat down with individuals in there, man, and the leaders of every single gang in there. I sat down with the leaders of pretty much every single gang. I'm talking from natives to skinheads, you name it, and came with propositions and proposals on how to make this prison work. And it's funny, and I didn't come with a proposition or proposal how to make this prison get crazier, but I came with a proposition and proposal how to make this prison work better for us. And it was some criminal thinking, you know what I mean? But we wanted to make sure we were cool.
But you had to be a politician.
And, yeah, so I had to sit down when there was an issue with another dude, a black dude got into it with a skinhead, and it looked like there was going to be a blow up. I had to go to this dude, or they would come to me, TJ, we need to talk. And they'd be like, and I was trusted and respected to the point where whatever decision I came up with, they knew it was the most logical decision because I was a logical thinker.
Absolutely.
And I would give them an option. I would say, hey, man, this is what it is. It doesn't have to go to the extreme because in the circumstances it can take care of him like this, or you can just say, fuck it, bro, and we can just tear the whole yard up.
Facts.
And it was just, that's how it had to be like yeah. that. Because you can't sit here and think you're just going to be the negotiator and the soft shoe guy. You had to be the guy that, here's the logic, here's the facts, we can deal with it as men, or you know how we get down, we can shut the whole yard down.
Period.
And nobody wants that. But the thing is, when I got out of that, I went and told my partners, I said, hey, you know what, man? It was something like in that 10-year part where I was like, you know what? Something that, I no, this is what it was. I'm going to tell you exactly what that turning point was.
Come
and,
on,
and it's
Ray.
Important that I say this. But it was something, and it was very emotional for me. My father had got cancer. He had sarcoidosis of the lungs, right?
Okay.
And I'm his only son. And he had said something to me that was so, I don't know, it shook me to my core. It was the only thing that ever shook me to my core, being involved in gangs. And what made me pull all the way back in this direction, say, you know what? I got to do something different. That man said this one statement to me, man, and it play in my head every day. He said, son, you've been a gang member for over 30 years, man. He said, I'm dying. He said, you think I can get my son in my last years? Man, that,
yeah.
You know, I had to go to all my homeboys and say, hey, bro, I don't give a damn what you say. I'm finna go take care of my family, right? So, and it was a hard transition because you get those challenges.
Yeah.
And then you get the crazy part about the challenges, you get them challenges from these, you know, these gangsters saying, oh, this went soft. And I'm like, well, no, that's not the case. You can say because I'm trying to get with my family, get with what's going on and figure out who I am, because I neglected my family my whole life.
Of course.
And my family, I'm probably the only person that's been in jail in my family on both sides. Mm. So I'm sitting here and I had to tell my partners who I was real respecting. You talking about savages, gangsters, you talking about cats named. I'm in Oregon State Penitentiary.
Yeah.
You got cats in there doing life ain't
come on
now.
Come
you
on.
Know, they can and have nothing to lose.
Easy.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's what I was up against.
Yeah.
And I said this, I'm like, this is where it is, this is what it is. And a lot of them was like, man, I understand, you know, because a lot of us were going through a lot of traumatic stuff, and then we was losing our mothers, our fathers, mm-hmm. our kids were getting mm-hmm. killed. So we was, it was that balance of trying to maintain, you know, who you was as a G. And then it was that other balance of, now you got to go in your cell and cry like a, excuse my metal. Well, that's what we, you know.
Yeah, yeah, no, you get
in there, you know what I'm saying? I'm so.
This tin can phone, man.
I'm saying we crying like a little, like you crying like a little. So mm-hmm. you got to go in your cell, and OSP got the open cell, so you got to get over there and.
Yeah, yeah.
And get your little cry on, and then come back. Yeah, what's up, G? You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And it was crazy hell like that, man. But there was a few cats in there that felt like, oh, he didn't win soft, or what's going on, because I was doing this transition, which of course brought me to this point. But there was those few that tried to buck up, and I thought to myself, wait a minute, bro, you ain't never been hard.
Come on.
Now I'm saying you a gangster because I decided to go in this direction. Uh-huh. And at one point, I had to literally go up there and say, hey, man, here's a piece of line paper, and here's a pen. Any of y'all want to come see me, man, sign up.
Come on. It was just that simple. Come on.
And I was still fighting to get to my family. But I knew, my family knows none of this stuff, because I never exposed them to all the crap that was going on with the prison, because I didn't want them to worry more than what it was.
Absolutely.
So they didn't know about all this shit I was going through. You know, I had to, every now and again, I had to, well, what's happening? We got, you know what I'm saying?
No,
and
that's you
what
got it to. Was. Yeah,
and,
you got to.
And I go, sit down, man. You know what I mean? And man, but other cast is like, hey, man, this dude trying to get to this point, man. If we catch you messing with this dude, it's gonna be a problem.
Yes.
But the reward was, I was able, because of that personal decision that I made, you know, to say, you know what, screw everybody, it is what it is, I'll go through hell and high water, you know, to honor my father's wishes.
Mm-hmm.
You see what
mm-hmm.
I'm saying? So when I got to that point, then they started saying, hey, man, wait a minute, this cat is really, he's really doing what he said he's doing. But it wasn't just about me and getting with the family. Everything I was doing in there, I was helping brothers get resources, helping brothers get home. And man, I had cats say, hey, man, I ain't gonna ride. You know, I don't even know you, man. Your girl need to bring your kids up here. I have my girl get. So I start doing stuff on a personal level, show cats. Look, I'm really about y'all, man. I'm really about you coming home. It's not just about me, but I got something I have to do.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? So it was that transition, man. It was up and down, but eventually I got to that point to where the respect came on another level. You see what I'm saying?
And it's different for what you being respected for.
Yeah.
It's different for what you being respected for. I think for me too, like in the beginning, just being younger, you know what I'm saying? Being younger and rest in peace to my brother Ben. Like I said, he the reason why I'm the misfit. And making that transition, I think a lot of the battle came with myself. Like after I would let a situation slide, you feel me? I'm on the bunk like, damn, I should just, like I'm finna let that slide for real? Like, nah, I'm not finna let that slide, bro. I gotta go see about that. Did you experience that to where like on the inside you like kind of, I don't know, maybe like channel, like a lot of times, like you said in my head, I just be like, nah, you's a bitch now. Like, bro, you gotta go, we not moving like that. And that was the biggest challenge, more than any outside people or entities, any outside, like within myself, really realizing like what they say, when you do the right thing, it feel wrong. You know what I'm saying? Like it feel like you're doing something bad when you do the right shit. I used to let things slide and it used to just eat at me. So I had to get over that part, because I was a running back king. Like I'll let it go right now, but we finna run that back, you know? So like,
I just think like that's the struggle, right? Inside, like there's always every day, and just like out here, there's choices every day. Yeah. And a lot of times in there, it's like the choice between like violence or a different path, right?
Yeah.
Or negativity and positivity, if we want to put it that way. Or even sometimes just what feels like a challenge to you or your safety mm-hmm. could put you in a situation where you feel like, if I don't do this, then I'm at risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or people will see me in a certain way. And that becomes like this part of the culture. I mean, that's what you guys had to overcome, especially like living in like a gang situation and moving through that and carrying that with you, and then coming out and having other obstacles and or people who had serious drug addictions. That's so many of the people that we saw on the inside, right? Mm-hmm. And people that we've lost, like friends of ours that came out and are now no longer with us because of either gangs or drugs or violence. And it's like, I think that none of us, I think, would dismiss like what the prison experience, like how it changed us, mm-hmm. right? Like how it changed us, whether it acculturated us a little bit and had some negative effects, but also the things that we like burned out, like the things we got rid of and cast off and mm-hmm. said, that's not part of my life anymore. Like I'm changing or doing something different or moving in a direction, you know?
I was just gonna say, I think it's purpose too. Like in the moments of you getting locked up, you probably at the height of whatever your purpose is. So if you in the streets with it and your purpose is banging, when you get locked up, that like I'm reaching these certain heights, But then, you know, getting incarcerated, like they always say, like, it's so crazy that they always say, you know, you do the time, don't let the time do you. It plays in my head and I laugh at that, because I really just be like realizing what that mean. You get what I'm saying? Like, to really educate yourself and really prepare yourself for, like you said, the battle coming home. And it is challenging. Like, it's challenging to, like, especially when you see old faces inside, it's easy to be like, man, I'm not f***ing with him. I'm not f***ing with him. I'm not f***ing with him. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. But then when you out here and you free, like, we, again, we watched our brothers deteriorate within months of being free to be able to just make their own choices. It's scary to me because these was, like, some of the guys that I was, like, down there looking up to. I think they took the place of, like, the big homies from the hood, and because they was telling me, like, you know, on this path, like, it's different when you got somebody to root for you. A lot of times we don't got nobody that's going to root for us unless we doing the wrong thing.
Sure.
You get what I'm saying? But when you really got somebody to root for you, that's like, bro, you really hella smart, though. Like, you can go to college. Like, I can go to college. Oh, yeah, this is tripping. You know, but, like, when you had that little bit of support, bro, you could make it so far. But
so there's a lot of interesting things coming up here, and kind of what Blue was saying is kind of getting to the other heart of the issue. So we just spent an episode's length talking about non-unanimous jury decision, how the legal side of it. But then what's coming up now is that there's persecution on the other side of it, right? From your own community, there's an expectation to be doing things and behaving in a certain way that is in opposition to the either successfully not being convicted or being able to appeal to an appeal, or after you've served your time to, like, maintain on a path. And so I kind of, again, really raise up kind of advocacy that you were doing to support guys who were, you know, still not knowing about all the stuff. But something that, so I'm curious, so we were talking about where you came up. Were you hanging out with Papa Smurf?
Here's the thing. No, I know him, bro. And like I said, I got a lot of love for pretty much everybody in the city of Portland. I know them all.
Yeah.
It's funny that you say that, because me and him actually, I was in a county jail on this case, and he was on a county jail on another case.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was looking for an attorney that was on a case I had before, you know, I was in a criminal lifestyle, but, and he was like, oh, I got that attorney and she's on my case. And I'm like, well, blah, blah, blah. And he's shot me a lot of stuff because I got the law libraries,
right.
You know, so he shot me a lot of stuff under the door into the unit.
Right.
I think I was on 6A or something like that.
Yeah.
And I got it. And that was about the last interaction I actually had with him.
Right.
And he had got my attorney and I needed her for this case, but she was caught up in his case because it was so complicated.
Right.
But that was probably my only interaction with him, but I know you're trying to dig into my past.
Well, not, I mean, I you know, it was a specific connection that was appealing to a general thing, because, you know, you're talking about growing up in the Albina region.
Yeah.
I know Papa Smurf from CRCI and learned about his story, particularly on the street, his upbringing, his father, all that kind of stuff. And so it was really personally captivating. He's half Italian, half Black, so am I. So there was, like, this interesting connection there. You know, I was telling you that I do work at King and Tubman and Jeff. And, you know, that's why, you know, after the show, we'll kind of do a little bit more of a download on that. But as it pertains, one of the things that Tin Can Phone, Gallery Blue, which is a gallery project that Blue and I are working on and Queez has been part of as well, I got invited by Cleo Davis, who's a local kind of artist organizer, and Nina Amstutz to do an exhibition. They are doing an exhibition about the recent unrest and the police action, and particularly the use of tear gas in communities. They were kind of like, oh, we want you to, like, interview young guys or whatever. And I was like, well, at this moment, I don't even have those relationships and could make them. But the way I'm interested in it, and one of the kind of poetic layers, is that they did some tear gassing near an elementary school, and they tested the soil near the elementary school, and it was, like, contaminated. And so I'm like, we are poisoning, like, the seed pod. You know what I mean? Like, we are really, the evidence we have for that is dudes who are older, who have the story of being kind of policed way back. And so I'm curious, because I was not clear in at the beginning, you're like, okay, a non-unanimous jury, it could have been a fluke, right? But we're not talking about a fluke, we're talking about a lifestyle that kind of culminated in a certain kind of thing. And so I'm curious about, yeah, like, you coming up in the neighborhood, and how much, and now all the stuff we're talking about, all the persecution, all the complexities of both sides, the government and the community, what was it like coming up, and how was policing influencing your development?
I'm that's got me thinking a little bit, because
that's what we do here.
I knew right from wrong
right
at a young age.
Yeah.
You know, I knew if I was doing this, you know, I knew consequences.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at 10, 11, 12, I chose to do things so I can get away with them. But I actually went to King School.
Okay. I thought that might have been the case, yeah.
And I had to have a 3-point whatever and write an essay to get into Benson High School. So I went to Benson Polytechnic High School with a almost a 4-point grade average. I was right. always intelligent.
Right.
Well, I got to claim myself. So I guess my turning point was, I guess, in 89. It was, me and my sister were struggling. And I had to get to a point to where I had to start selling drugs in my freshman year of high school to be able to get me and my sister some clothes for school.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I was kind of introduced to the police interactions. Right. Actually, I take that back. I hated the police in third grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to root that part of it to show that journey. And it was because I stayed in Bakersfield, California. I remember I stayed on 510 K Street, Apartment B. And I remember going to school one day, and I was, you know, the school bus stop was about 4 blocks from my home.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I always grew up when it says the doors of the church are open. You know, they're mm-hmm. always open. You come in there for the building. You know, I'm a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember walking up into the church, waiting for the bus and using the restroom, and they called the police on me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first interaction with the police, so I hated authority from that point forward,
right?
And then my second, of course, interaction when I was out there selling drugs and trying to get stuff from my sister and myself. So, you know, interacting with I was kind of in the gangs, kind of wasn't in. I was in the gangs, but I don't know, 89 was pretty active. I'm not going to take that. Yeah, I was. It was pretty wild back then. I didn't really have no interactions with the police until 89.
Sure,
that's what it was. Because, you know, I was doing stuff before then. But, and I had authority issues. You know what? It's something else to tie to that. I'll keep it brief. What it is my grandfather was a military, right? And with him, you know, if you wasn't military, if your hair was long, you were a sissy. You know, this was the things he called. When I had my jury career, he was like, you look like a sissy because mm-hmm. my hair wasn't cut low.
Yeah.
And he was always, everything's folded. And this is the way he was, right? So I had authority issues even within my family. My whole side, pretty much the side of my dad's family, all Marines.
Right.
Right. And once my grandfather had tainted me with his version of who I am, who I should be, I kind of lost respect for the entire family because, like, you're all associated with Marines. I have this other. And I was like, if you're black fighting for the American Army, you ain't shit. That's how I felt back then, right? Because I had my own belief system. So, like I said, I've always had these authority issues as a child.
Mm-hmm.
But my interaction with the police only happened from third grade into 12th grade. I mean, ninth grade.
They're specific.
Yeah, and so forth, right? But my relationship with the police was horrible. Every time I interact with them, I got my ass whooped. There's been times where they told me to shut up and spray mace in my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, can you really deploy mace in the back of my throat?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I thought it was a diffuse, whatever the situation is, and subdue, whatever.
Yeah.
And I just remember I didn't get my ass whooped and got beat up, left to the side of the road. This is in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
This is when it was just the first two gang task forces.
Yeah.
They didn't know how to deal with Portland gangs.
Right.
They had like a blue gang task force car and like a gray one.
Right.
Right. Regular old Chevy Caprices or whatever.
Right.
And because the gang violence was starting up. So
yeah.
I didn't really have no police interaction.
Sure.
Right. Because we knew how to manipulate the regular police.
Right.
But then, I think every time I got pulled over by the police, by 70% of the time, I got my ass whooped, man.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know how to shut my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I didn't have no driver's license. I didn't care. But it was like, who are you? You know what
right.
I mean? I do what I want to do. But some of it was on me and some of it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I may have been the passenger. Sometimes I may have been walking down the street. And this is when they had that, hey, come here. You know, I'm lying. And they stopped me. I was like, wait a minute. I didn't know about the stop and frisk laws.
Right.
I didn't know about evidentiary rules that you couldn't do this and this and that.
Right.
Right? We didn't know about the stuff in the streets.
Yeah.
So I'm getting stopped. Throwing stuff, and I'm doing all this stuff, not even knowing, no, you can't touch me, you can't stop me. I didn't know this stuff.
Right.
So, yeah, it was, I mean, I can tell you a thousand stories, man, but 70% of the time, man, I got my ass whooped.
Sure.
By the police.
I mean, one of the reasons I bring this up is because extensively covered kind of like the upper level law component, and I think the thing that kind of really is invisible is like the persecution that exists pre-conviction that kind of breeds, you know, or seeds or fuels the flame of what is the, I mean, because the issue is larger than can be said in a sentence. I mean, essentially it's like part of the issue is like actual trauma and individual struggle, poverty, all this stuff leads you to think gangs, stuff like that. And the government is in no way supporting development, helping you navigate the emotional stuff, is kicking you when you're down. And then, you know, you commit a crime and whenever you get into this other legal side of it. The other reason I'm bringing it up, and you know, the whole gang, which remains we have an hour long interview we did with Papa Smurf inside CRCI, and he really chronicles this, like being one of the early sparks of the kind of like Crip Blood Portland era. And also, meanwhile, in this recording, here he is at his most like, that is a past, I'm getting ready to get out and be a father to my kids kind of deal. And he's like, I'm running for mayor, right? And he's got this platform that's like, he's trying to bring awareness to the stuff. But the way that he also talks about the existence of gangs is that, and that's why I was really kind of captivated in like your transitional moment, which is like slow in the ability to kind of shirk this stuff, but remaining a pillar in the community of goodness and righteousness. And so that is the interesting layer to me, is that essentially a gangs kind of came into existence primarily in order to like take care of the community itself. And so that has been kind of, you know, I think there's aspects of that that are condemned by former gang members, but that spirit remains and, you know, is kind of like antagonized beginning in the youth, and it is continued to be policed and convicted in your kind of like mid, as Quee said, like claim to rise. And then there's that post era that, due to the way that the government or our society is structured, never gets to go away. And so it remains a hanging chad of a point to me, where I have never talked to someone, particularly in the non-unanimous category, particularly in unsexy crime category, where it's like, okay, you've served your time, you have a new orientation on life, this person is ready to reintegrate into society and to be a productive member, but you are actively rejecting them. And
I need to say something on that. And I try to give everybody the benefit of the doubt, because I try to look for things from everybody's standpoint before I make an overall decision or pass judgment, which I try not to do. I knew one thing coming out. Last year, I had a struggle. I actually was homeless for about 9 months. Nobody knows my story. And the reason why is because when I got out, I was married, right? You know, and I'm not going to go down that story, but we parted amicably within the first 3 or 4 months of me coming out. And that was seen as everything is finna crumble, because I was one of the first people got out on clemency. What it was is, this is crazy too, when that happened, everybody had got the word that I was separated from my wife, I just got out, oh, what's gonna happen to him? So now everybody had these narratives, right? Oh, he's going to a tent, oh, he's on meth, oh, I say, oh, he's looking like this. And I'm thinking to myself, no, I got out with shit. I may look like a whole bunch of damn things because I don't have shit, right? But I wasn't dirty enough. I had plenty of clothes, but it was just, I didn't have nothing. I had the raggedy car, you know, enough to get around, and hopefully I can drive from A to B that day. But I didn't have no place to stay because I chose to leave amicably, whatever the situation was. But because I left, there was these narratives that were created. And not only am I fighting an old narrative of what I went to jail for, you know what I mean? I'm coming out like, oh, he's out. The last thing I left on their mind was this guy that did these crimes. Mm-hmm. So now I'm coming out talking about, oh man, I'm well educated, I'm ready, I got a network system, I got blah, blah, blah. But I didn't have all that coming out, because when you're married coming out, all those resources they have didn't apply to me, except for, you know, Affordable Care Act. I went to all these different organizations, these black organizations, we can get you into this, we can get you into that. This was 3 months after, you know, I separated from my wife, because I wasn't fully divorced. Her income still aligned with me, even though I wasn't bringing in any money, right? So now I couldn't get any resources. So I was homeless all this time, right? And I realized, well, my uncle let me stay on his couch from time to time, well, majority of the time. And I realized, man, that I got pissed off and frustrated with everybody around here about how they were speaking on me. But all I kept doing was giving them very little evidence of seeing who I was and who I transitioned to be, right? Because I was out here kind of, I was screwed up, man, no job. And I'm sitting there trying to figure this out, right? So the first thing I did when they got me a little EBT card, you know what I mean? I said, okay, I'm gonna do this. And then I, you know, rest after people like Aliza Kaplan, you know, and stirred me to, you know, Miss Karen Kane. And then I ended up getting a temporary job at All Star, you know, and then I went in there, and because the way I talked, I ended up getting a $16 job turned into a $30 an hour job, you know what I mean? So now I don't say I wasn't reacclimating myself, I was acclimating my life or however I thought it should be. And I realized that all the people that I was running from, you know what I mean, were also in, I didn't say they were involved in a narrative. I thought to myself, maybe they're believing this narrative because I haven't reached out to none of them.
right? This was all last year. I didn't reach out to nobody that supported me because I wanted to show everybody I can do it myself. But in the meanwhile, nobody knew the struggles. So when I say people were saying narratives on who you are, not giving me a chance to persecute, I was giving them reasons to keep, continue to persecute me because I wasn't showing, trying to, you know, who I was and what I, whatever the struggles was. I guess I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do. So what I did is I got up this year and I told myself, I think I got invited on January 1st. I got invited by friend Scott Spencer Wolf to one of Dave Dahl's penthouse downtown, right? And I went downtown and we sat up in the penthouse and we talked. Yeah. And then he took me out to Dave Dahl's from Discover African Art out there, and I went in the museum, looked at stuff, and I was deciding to kind of get a job there. But then I thought to myself, maybe this is a start of me reaching back out. So as I started to reach out, I realized, no, if I continue to sit over here and pout and do whatever I want, you know, and be pissed off how people's narrative of me, that's what's going to narrative is going to continue to be. So I went out there and started creating my own narrative. You know what I mean? Because I wanted the people to see what I was doing, see this transition, and also let them see my struggles as I'm going through these transitions, because I wanted to be fully transparent. I'm not going to let you write my story. You're not going to persecute me. You can say what you want to say, but I'm going to show you this, 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 and that, no matter where I go to these points, but this is who I am. Hence, that's where all this stuff. So this year has been a very busy year. I've came back to now where I have a full-time job now, career job, benefits. Now I can be over here and be a peer mentor for Willamette University of Regroup outside of that. Now I can go over here and say I have a business, you know what I mean, that I'm starting a business in Tualatin. Actually, I'm starting a scooter business in Tualatin called Hop. I bought into a franchise, right? I sat down with the director, Nick Wessendorf, that directs the whole city, and said, come on in, here's the contract, and welcome me into the city. You know what I'm saying? I'm doing commercials on my scooters. Now I'm a member of the Tualatin Chamber of Commerce. Now I'm a member of the Black Advisory Business Council within the Chamber of Commerce. You know what I mean? So now I've acclimated these people around me, and it went from me being homeless last year and all people's narrative, and I realized I had to start writing my narrative because the last impression I left on my community, well, I was a gang member, tearing they up, doing this, controlling shit. So who am I to say, why are you still looking at me like I'm that? Because that's the last thing I left in your mouth. That's the last vision I gave you. So in my story, I realized that I had to change that narrative and show them. And it wasn't I had to prove who I was. It was that it was a lot up against me. I was out on the clemency. And then to go back to what you said earlier in the broadcast, one of the main things that pushed me every single day, and it's really simple. I can say all this other stuff, but it's as simple as this. What if I was sitting in that cell talking about, oh, Johnny just got out, man. I hope he said he's going to do what he said he's going to do, man. And I'm sitting there every day, man, hoping that you stay true to your word so I can have an opportunity to come home or create a path or a platform where I can be able to at least say, hey, man, this is why I'm trying to come home, or let me get into this court system. So I had to put myself in the brother's shoes that are in there, the sister's shoes that are in there, and say, you know what? I hate to be the guy that says you're institutionalized or you have all these criminal ways of thinking, you have this, or you need to, you know, family say this all the time, man, leave that prison behind. I'm like, no, because what if the dude that got out that said he was gonna do what he do just left me behind? Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm not leaving nobody behind, right? So at the end of the day, that's the reason why I do what I do every single day, is because I was sitting there and listening to everybody's story, everybody's narrative, everybody's transition, everybody's hope, everybody's dream. I watched their kids through my parenting inside out classes and courses. I watched all these interactions, and I said to myself, when I get home, I'm going to make sure as many of those people can get out as possible, because I understand the system now. I understand. But I don't, yeah.
Takuma, sometimes during that time when you're houseless and you're in that struggle, were there times that you're like, I don't know how this is going to go. I don't know which direction this is going to go. Or did you always have faith? Because I've seen extraordinary people. Queez is an extraordinary guy, but there's a lot of people that are extraordinary on the inside. Ben, our friend who is gone, was beautiful, genius, and a writer. And I know a lot of people on the inside that are brilliant and still choose to live in the life that is going to take them down a path that's not going to work in terms of like being free and living, like, I guess, I don't know, what I say as work is like within the positive social context that we kind of like re-enter into. Queez, I want to hear about you like turning yourself in and like talking about that when you were also going down really good paths and having to go and do that. But I guess first I just want to know, Takuma, were there times like that's that struggle that can make or break somebody, right?
Like there. I almost went to prison about 5 times.
Yeah.
Throughout that struggle. There's been times, and in full transparency, there's been times I was sitting in my truck and my cousin had went to a car lot and asked somebody to do a favor for him. Give me a car because I couldn't afford to pay for it because I needed transportation. You know what I was thinking about? I need that one, so I need transportation and somewhere I can sleep just in case, right? So I had to get the right vehicle, right? And this is where I was in survival mode. Yeah. which was bad for me. Because when I'm in survival mode, then I slip into criminal mode. Because I'm thinking to myself, I come out here and there was a culture shock out here for me, a major culture shock. The culture shock for me was nobody gave a fuck about each other but themselves. I said, this is not the Portland that I fucking left. This is bullshit. And you got to remember, when I got out, before Biden came down there and gave them all that money for their charging system, the homeless are still out there. So this is what I came out to the all the tents out here. And I almost started to cry, man. And I thought to myself, and I seen all my old friends I used to run the streets with out here. I'm like, what the? And I'm sitting, I'm discouraged. And then I found myself slipping in that situation, following that narrative. He slips back in, he goes back to prison, blah, blah, blah. I was sitting in my car, no place to go. I didn't want to go to my mama's house, be this grown. My mama's door was open 24/7. But I didn't want to be that grown man going to land at my mama's house. I had too much pride, right? So I remember sitting in my truck one night and damn near cried in that moment. I was like, and the reason why I cried, it wasn't because of the state of the situation I was in. Man, I cried because of the thoughts I was having. I said, man, I'm not going to live like this, man. This. And I started going into those old criminal thoughts, right? And then I got to thinking to myself, I was like, man, what the? But it's hard. You know what I'm saying? You wake up the next day talking about, okay, man, I got a quarter tank of gas. I can go to this side of town today, maybe kick it, or I can go to this side of town in hopes I can get some more gas to get back to this. And that was the struggle on a daily basis, right? But I never, and I think what killed me was I had an old partner, man, I thought had my back. And they showed their true colors, and I just left it alone. I was like, you know, it is what it is. But it was a further reminder that it's like everybody was for themselves, right? And when I say everybody for themselves, I walked up into black organizations here in the city of Portland. Prominent black, I'm not even going to blast them, prominent. I know some of these people growing up, they're in positions. And I said, man, I'm homeless, man. I got the situation, man. This is, I ain't got nothing. You know what I told a couple of those when I walked out of there, man? I've never walked in an organization, felt like I left less than what I came in with. And they still didn't reach back at me. So yeah, the struggle was real, man. I had contemplated a whole bunch of stuff, and by the grace of God, man, I just kept sitting there and struggling through it. And I think my uncle let me stay there, gave me the reprieve that I needed, because he said, man, just get on your feet, nephew. You know what I mean? And it gave me a time to breathe and to think. And I was able to say, you know what? Let me start reaching out. Hence what I was talking about earlier. I reached out to Aliza. You know, and I got that ball rolling.
You never knew who that one person was going to be either, right? That just
no,
says, like,
I just called her out of the blue. I was sitting there with everybody, like, and she met with me, got me coffee, and we talked. And she gave me the direction that I needed. Never looked back.
Like, I see you. Yeah. I think that was a big one, big for me.
Something I was thinking about earlier is, like, I mean, you don't know. I've never been incarcerated. I kind of came in as an artist, was doing work, met the guys. I think learning the kind of human nature of the issue, I'm kind of like hooked in a way. Like, I won't go into it. It feels like an active war front that I don't know how to turn my back on, and have lost lives, and a lot of people are still kind of flapping out there. So all that's going on. But it's interesting, something that we were talking about earlier is, I often will tell people, like, oh, I do tin can phone, it started inside, and I like leave it highly ambiguous. They like, are you in prison? And I just like don't answer, right? And so I'm kind of subjecting myself to that. But what happens, I think, for everyone is in this room, myself included, is when we talk about these things, but they like, you're like a good guy, they kind of like let it go. But if they have a reason to kind of like persecute, they will. But the interesting layer about all this is, so you got out on clemency, and this is all contemporary. So some of the time, like some of the stuff we're talking about is like older, but I guess actually this whole show is kind of predicated on folks who got out during COVID. But so you were a clemency person and you just got out and you had to fight yourself to stay on the track. And so some of what we're talking about, and again, is interesting. So this show is primarily just citizen audience, and every citizen is in this place and they stand in a position of judgment of whether they're going to trust you or not or whatever. And I appreciate that you listed all of these accomplishments where you are now, but just that long ago, you were literally houseless and you were like maybe going to fall off the tracks again. And so how much it actually takes to like stay the course, how hard it is without anyone actively trying to screw you over, but how close it can be for anyone to just like not make it. And I think that that's like predominantly, I mean, the stats on it is most of the folks are kind of recidivism kind of situation. And as Blue mentioned, either like die or still navigating drugs. And so that is kind of what for me kind of makes the whole thing seductive and gets back to this kind of like conversation around the documentary is just that average citizens are trying to pass judgment on folks where all they need is someone to like put out a hand and help someone up. And what they're doing is kind of sitting in their insulated position. It's like, well, I'm comfortable and this could be dangerous to me. And so instead of doing the internal work, which is, you know, we want the stability of government and we want to critique government. And when it's like, okay, this is an issue in which you can take a position and be an advocate as a citizen, folks want to say like, ah, I'm going to let the government handle that. Like, don't call the cops. But if something happened, call the cops. You know, they just like want to be cool until it's something they can't handle. And this is like a really safe version of it. Post-carceral, whatever people think, whether they believe prison can be rehabilitatory or not, it's actually the time to reach out and hold. But no one, it's such like we're all in this room and there's all these extreme stories because there is so few middle ground. And people, this is what happened to me all the time. I'll be talking to, you know, layman folks. And I'm like, oh, I do this thing in prison, whatever. They're like, whoa, you go to prison? Whoa. And I'm like, yeah, like I walked in. I didn't like get some special presidential letter of ability to go do anything. You just walk in and, you know, it's like, what do you need? Lunch? A ride? Someone to like hear how you're getting screwed and say that sucks? You know, it's not a superpower. But, you know, folks, what they're doing is like, well, let me be a judge, jury, and executioner. Like, what you got going on? I want to know all your stuff. Meanwhile, like, what kind of secrets they got? Like, what kind of stuff are people doing that they don't want people to know? And there's no expectation to disclose or anything, you know? So there's just a lot, you know, again, that's why I thought it was a little interesting when you came in. You're like, I don't want to take the platform. I mean, that is the platform. The platform is to help not people who are more distant from this context understand that they are also on the front line of this issue and they too can. And meanwhile, it is folks who suffered incarceration, are navigating their own traumas related to it, navigating, finding housing or all kind of work, all the kind of stuff, and are like the post-prison lawyer, advocate, activist, all this stuff. And there's prominent organizations that are community organizations that, you know, in this 21st century, in the time of tent cities and clean sweeps and, you know, decriminalization of drug use, which is interesting and helpful, and at the same time just not continuing to not address the issue, because I am not aware of and have surfed at this point closely drug programs that are really like, you know, it's just kind of drunk tank stuff, like let's get you good enough to get you back on the street, but it's not let's appeal to these emotional issues, let's appeal to this historical trauma you got going on. None of that. I mean, I can't square folks, I can't even get therapists. You know, someone who doesn't know how to use a cell phone yet is not getting the attention they need. So, you know, that was the kind of line of inquiry I just wanted to bring up at this point. It's free swim.
I had a lot I was thinking about while bro was talking about getting out to the world and how it is now, like the back door, you know what I'm saying? It became so popular to play your homie, kill your homie, pretty much put him up for sale, you know what I'm saying? Largely to do with rap, you know what I'm saying? And I feel like that's a big system that I find myself battling in the sense of like, you know, I could go live and have 10, 15 people on live compared to a rapper going live and having 10, 15,000, you know? So just fighting that bigger machine. And then like locally, stature, it's like, you know, the government's been doing it for years to destroy any like organization. You just give them money, you know what I'm saying? And that's going to always cause a separation, just like with the Black Lives Matter movement, just like with all the local movements that was going on. We was beginning to see, you know, a little change. We was beginning to see unity. We was beginning to see all these different things. And then they start passing out all this money. And then we went right back to even unemployment being a thing, that we went right back to, shit, as long as I'm having more than him, I'm cool. I'm eating over here. It ain't no need to help. It ain't no, you know, so that's always been like a thing that we've been battling as far as people over profit, you know what I'm saying? And understanding to invest in our people, to invest in, me and my brother BG always talk about it, relationship equity and bringing value back to relationships. And I think that's what Tin Can Phone and everything that we build is like, you know, to bring back value into the relationships, and not, it doesn't matter about how much money you got. You know what I'm saying? It's about the relationship that you built on your journey. And for you, it's just like fear. A lot of fear stop people from making certain steps. And one thing I got from Smurf, he used to always say, hashtag, why not me? Why not start with me? And I kind of took that and was just like, damn, if I want to see this change, or if I want to see the youth get led in this direction, I'm old enough to be with my OG homies, but I'm also young enough to be that bridge, because I really be out there with my youngins. So like, it has to start with me. Just for me, like coming back from Cali, and me and Michael, we all knew going back and doing that time was something that just had to happen. Like, it was never no, this may not happen. I told myself that a couple times, like, maybe I don't got no warrant. Nah, I don't think I might not have.
Say that a couple of times.
Yeah, I might not, you know, but ultimately just knowing like the situation that I put myself in, you know what I'm saying? Like, by leaving, like, I knew I wasn't done with parole, you know what I'm saying? But I also, like, again, this is where it gets tricky with that repeat offender mindset. Like, prison wasn't hard, you know what I'm saying? So if this is y'all ultimate scale of punishment for whatever I do, I'm gonna go do what the fuck I want, because this ain't hard. Like, it became home. It became like I could go do this. Like, as soon as I touched down, and that's the thing too with people falling off the wagon when they get in these certain situations, knowing, you know, I was just sleeping in my car not too long ago. And some people only identity or their best identity is when they locked up. So if shit get too hard out here, you know, at least I know when I get back to the joint, it'll be this. Now I fall into this structure and I know I'm only gonna get 18 months or 24, like, they're not going back for the fives and the tens and the, so like, that's why a lot of people fall off sometimes. For me, 10 can phone play a big role, because I'd be like, okay, I really got the youth that's really like paying attention to me, like my they really tapping in now, they're really like showing, like, you know, like trying to see, do something different. So if I just take something like one of those challenges, you ask God for strength, he ain't gonna give you bigger muscles, he gonna give you challenges. Get through these challenges to get stronger, to get wiser. So like, for me, it's like, I always think about listeners. I always think about the ones that's watching, because you never know who's watching. You never know who's learning from you. You never know who's paying attention. So that's why you got to continue to keep stepping and making those right moves, because you don't know who life you affecting. Because sometimes they don't reach out because they be scared. Like, everybody's scared to be the one to do it first. You get what I'm saying? So I knew I had to go to jail, and I just had to get back into the mindset. The scary part for me was, I know what trauma comes with that, and I know the beast that I become, because I had to do Cali time. I had to do all these different years and all these different facilities. And like I said, I'm a child of the system. So in order to navigate through the system as I do, it's beast mode. Like, I know I can't go in there and be Queez, the activist or the philosopher. Like, nah, bro, I'm finna come in here and I'm finna smash on whatever's moving. I'm finna, you know? And then I went and I built up the courage to actually go. And when I got in there, I just realized, like, damn, I don't even got to turn into that dude. Like, who I am now started in prison, in a situation where this is built on hate. This whole facility, this whole system is built on hate. And this is where the journey started. So, like, it was easy for me to go turn myself in, bro. Like, it's always been what's going to happen after. Like, going to do the time, that shit is nothing. Going to do the time is nothing. But what's going to happen after, though? And again, like I said, when you come home, the hardest part about life is getting your life back. It don't belong to you when you got parole or all these different people looking at you all these different ways. Like, it really don't belong to you. And we start living, like I said, we live into what we think people see. You know what I'm saying? Like, when you go into these jobs or you go into these establishments, sometimes I just feel like, oh, they know. Like, they see me, like, they know. But that's just, you know, insecurities. That's just, you know, carrying around that fear of, you lose yourself, you know? You lose sight of who you are when you got to go into them cages and you got to be in there and you got to make it out. You got to make it home to your family. You kind of lose sight of yourself. So when you come home, it's just about, like, not falling back into, especially being somebody of influence. That's the hardest thing for me, because I mess up, you feel me? I be slipping, I behavior relapsing for me. It ain't never really been drugs, it's been gangster shit. That's my relapse, getting back into some gangster shit. So, kids, you know what I'm saying? I got my daughter, I see every day my daughter, yeah, my phone was on, she probably would've, you feel me? Where y'all at? Y'all taking too long, come my son. So it's just like, you know, you just gotta like not be, you know, you never know who watching. I just know people be watching me. People be like really tapped into my Instagram, like, bro, you speaking that shit, bro, I really f*** with y'all. I hear you saying this and I, you know what I'm saying? But if you notice, when I start falling off and I start getting back into that behavior, I don't post no more. Ain't no more stories, ain't no more Instagram, ain't no more, because I know that I'm not in the right.
Spiritually. Right, but we know like all that stuff is from the inside out. Like, mm-hmm. Even the story that you were saying, like, that, you know, when we've done a decade or more, two mm-hmm. decades in prison, And people used to say, I can do, you know, this many months standing on my head. Like, we can, right? Doesn't mean that there's no danger in there, but we can, right? But I also had the story, I created the story in myself, which was like, I'm not going back under any circumstances. Right. Like, I was so spun out under my first PO that I was like, maybe I need to leave the United States and never come back. Like, I was spun out by this lady, like, to the point that, okay, if family ever wants to see me again, they're gonna have to come to wherever, right?
Yeah.
And that was the point, because I had that, that was my thinking, right? I knew that there was real pressure and real struggle coming at me from outside, just like each one of us has experienced, but also like how I dealt with that, I knew was like my internal stuff, right? And and it's interesting because like we, it's like two sides of the coin. Like, you know you can go in, you know you can do it, you know that you can either retain who you are or become something else. And each one of those is like a choice, and it's based on all of our beliefs. And I just think that's so amazing. And I just don't want to underplay the thing also about, you always had Michael, like when, wherever you were in California or wherever, those people that like step up and are like there for us through whatever, or Aliza, like anytime that I text or email Aliza, she gets back to me. And that's just like one aspect of the life. That's the legal thing. But I know who I can reach out to, and I know who's going to be there. Like,
I ain't going to lie. It's so hard, like, being for me. You know what I'm saying? It's so hard being my friend because of my trauma. You feel what I'm saying? Like, I ain't going to cap. I don't even know how Michael still. Because I be tripping. You feel me? Like, sometimes I really tripping. Like, I got so many other mental illnesses that I'm just now learning about, and different, like, little traits that I'm just now learning about that goes into, like, you know, with the trauma almost one, and, like, really understanding why I'm reactive the way I am. But like, for people I love, they get it the hardest. Like, as soon as I start feeling myself, you know what I'm saying, I'm gonna push you away, guaranteed. Like I don't know what that is. I just, you know, cause I just, like, I'm so used to being by myself. I could do this shit by myself. Like, I really could just do this shit by myself. You know what I'm saying? It don't really take no responsibility. I ain't gotta really, you feel what I'm saying? So the people that love me, and the people that wanna see me do right, the people that try to help me do right, I'm gonna push them away. And I'm going to probably gravitate back towards the motherfuckers who really don't care too much, because I'm starting not to care for myself type situation. But ultimately, I feel like I pay my debt to society. I did everything my PO asked of me, up to me leaving, even up to me coming back. Like I said, I'm in a place to face whatever I had to face.
Sure.
And I went and did that. Seeing his reaction to me turning myself in, seeing his ego hurt that he couldn't find me for however long.
Right.
He tried to give me, he tried to give me some other type of stipulations and all that. Off top, the Misfit ain't with none of that. So I feel like I'm doing what's right for one, myself, my kids, my family, and my mental health.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? I chose to not let him stress me out. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I chose to, like, so I made peace with, okay, whatever happened, gonna happen.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happened, gonna happen. But right now, I gotta have shelter, you feel me? I gotta have a job. I gotta have all the things that I had already lined up previous to going in. So I'm just at a place now where, figure it out.
Yeah.
Figure it out. You gonna get me doing the right thing.
Sure.
When you get me, you gonna get me doing the right thing. And whatever you wanna do after that, you already know what it is with me, Mike. Well, throw your punches.
I wanna throw out there just like we spent time thinking about our lives, right? Like, we weren't in there just playing games, although I played a lot of Scrabble. I mean, we were thinking about who we wanted to be. We were thinking about what we wanted to take in and what we wanted to, you know, give out to the world, right? Or to our friends, or even just to the sphere of influence right around us. The people who got to talk to you or you, they probably, you know, it was a different experience, right?
Yeah.
Because we thought about our lives, we thought about our health. And I think for me, mental health was definitely a big thing, understanding that it's like my experience in this moment is what's real. Like, the past is not real, the future is not real. Well, who I am in this moment is real. And I think just like being okay with that. I mean, still going.
I just real quick, like, I was willing to do whatever he wanted to do until I seen his reaction.
Right.
When I told him everything that I had and what was going on and about, and like my kids, his reaction was more of the cat and mouse game. His reaction was more about, yeah, but you was gone for this long and I couldn't find you. It was never about, it was never about like, when you come home, you got shelter, you got, once you showed me, you don't care. This is job city. Like, this is, you cannot get over the fact that I was gone.
Yeah.
Like, but I told him everything my whole life. Like, this is like, bro, I literally quit my job to come to jail and then had another job lined up for when I got out of jail.
Yeah.
You don't care about none of that.
Sure.
I couldn't. I like because no, you are no longer somebody who I feel like is has my best interest at hand. Like you can't. You can't.
Yeah.
If you said through everything I had lined up, you would rather me be homeless in the streets.
Sure. I mean, and that's like this is the perfect signatory is that it is those hands in which citizens are like, well, let them decide.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And they're unwilling to advocate. I mean, I've at this point written all kinds of letters and showed up and advocate support and even supporting the kind of doc to exist, all of the things that I do that I probably could do more, but I'm doing 99% more than any other average citizen.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, houselessness and mental health and drug and incarceration, all of this is being put in the hands of folks who it's their job to manage. I mean, I can't tell you the amount of times I'm driving around and I see the sweeps actively happening. And it's just people in jackets throwing shit away. I'm like, where's the mental health person? Where's the you know, what is the catch? There's no net. And this is the system that average citizens or even creatives and activists and they're like, well, someone else has got this. Well, if you're listening, they don't got it. It's time for you to step up to bat. Y'all ready to send us out of here? Thank you for being a guest. We really appreciate you. I'm sure you're relevant back on the show, but I will definitely be following up with you about some albino stuff. It was really great to have you.
Right here on 10 Can Fall. No, we don't like to let our guests leave without sending a message to the listeners. Anything that the youth that's listening, the ones that really don't have no understanding or don't know what's going on listening, a message that you would just like to carry on and that you would like to live forever.
Man, that's a loaded one because I got so many messages.
We'll have you back.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but at the end of the day, you know, if you really want the message, man, I just encourage you to try to just look me up, follow the story, man, see my journey. I just hope it, you know, my experience and strengths and hope resonate with you in some way, you know, and I'm an open book, you know, and man, you contact me, I'll answer your questions as best as I can, but I'm here to support you until my day's end.
Thank you. Hey, man, this your boy, Misfit Adi, 10 Can Phone. Hey, man, trauma almost won, but we ain't gonna let it. 10 Can Phone, Blue, what's happening? We out of here.
Bam.
Bam.
Thanks, Quiz. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah.
Thanks, Michael.
Until next time.
Takuma.
You are listening to the 10 Can Phone Podcast, where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the sources. We tell the stories from the inside out. So make sure to check us out on Cable Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m. You can also check us out on Spotify, Apple, and anywhere you love to catch your podcast. And make sure to give us a follow over at 10canphonepodcast.com. And follow our Instagram at 10canphonepodcast. This Misfit Adi signing off.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
During the last 6 weeks, you heard the special programming of our winter fundraising drive. Thank you for supporting Volume 2 of the All Thrills, No Frills